Okay, so today is Tuesday, September 24th. We're picking back up with chapter 5, looking at page 57. We're going to start off by discussing nails. It's interesting that fingernails and hair actually have a lot in common, especially in the way that they're structured. So, you know, when we talked about hair, we talked about hair having a follicle. We talked about a hair root. And what is the relationship between the follicle and the root? So for a hair, hair's had a follicle, hair's had a root. What's the relationship? Yeah, nails have a follicle, nails have a root. So if you want to absolutely kill any kind of growth coming from a fingernail or from a hair, what do you have to kill, the follicle or the root? The follicle, yeah, because the follicle actually gives rise to cells that grow and make the root. And the root, of course, it can be replaced if you happen to have a hair or nail fall out. But if you damage the hair follicle or if you damage the nail follicle, that's it. There's no more growth in that particular part. So if you slam your finger really hard in a door and you damage that nail follicle, the nail falls out, the nail will not regrow back. So, you know, that's critical for those follicles to stay alive. And just like with the hair, it's a layer of stratum basal that comes down and around the nail root, and it gives rise to that nail root that's kind of hidden up under your skin in that cuticle area. That's another good picture here. This layer coming around here is the nail follicle. It is stratum basal. It's actually a piece of the epidermis. It does give rise to the nail root, which is inside here. Okay. So nails, of course, are a little different in structure than hairs. Nails are actually made up of collagen and some cartilage, and they're meant to be rubbery, flexible to some extent, but they're also meant to act as a defense for the ends of our fingers. Okay, so the cuticle is a fold of skin. That's your blank there about halfway down page 57. So there's keratin in nails, there's collagen in nails, there's even cartilage in there that helps make them a little flexible. The cuticle is what protects the nail bed. So we were talking on Thursday about things that are considered accessory organs to your skin. We covered hair. We just now talked about nails. Let's now turn our attention to glands. So we've got two major types of glands associated with our skin. They're called sweat glands and oil glands. We're also going to learn them by their fancy names. Sweat glands are also called sudoriferous glands. And if you remember that sweat glands can make us stink, or there's a relationship to the odor that comes from having sweated, then sudoriferous, there's kind of the word odor hidden in that word. That may be a trick to keeping these two names straight. So sweat glands or sudoriferous glands are producing sweat, which is mostly water, onto your skin surface. Okay, so let's talk about the two types of sweat glands. These sweat glands are made up of a duct or a tube made up of simple cuboidal epithelium. You may recognize that in these pictures here. One type is called an apocrine or apocrine gland. That's our first blank. And the second blank is eccrine. So two types of sweat glands. First one there is apocrine or apocrine. And the second one is eccrine. So all this is the sweat gland associated with the hair or not? If the sweat gland is associated with the hair, we call it the first name, the apocrine gland. If there's no hair associated with the sweat gland, we call it by the second name, the eccrine sweat gland. So whether or not the sweat gland is associated with the hair, well, that's what makes the difference. Hairs are called apocrine, no hairs are called eccrine. Tell you an easy way to remember this. If you think about the word ape there and apocrine, apes are hairy, okay? And so if you've got hair with sweat glands associated, then that, of course, is an apocrine sweat gland. So these apocrine sweat glands are typically found in the stinky parts of our bodies. those would be your armpits, your groin, places that we don't normally go around enjoying the odor of those body regions, because apocrine sweat's a little different than typical sweat. It's actually got a milky component to it, a lipid component to it, and the sweat that comes from those apocrine glands are actually somewhat whitish in color, thanks to the fat that comes from those apocrine sweat glands. It is poorly understood why we have them, but we have some guesses as to why we have different sweat glands in the armpits and groin region. And if you think about how dogs greet each other, pheromones, yeah. So, you know, dogs don't necessarily come up and identify your face. Dogs come up and identify your butt, right? So there's some chemicals we think that might be released from those apocrine sweat glands that have to do with communication, or maybe just identifying us as who we are. So, you know, if you've ever had a dog, you know how they identify you. It's not visually, it's by odor. What's that?
Very personal.
Very personal, yeah. It feels invasive, in fact. So, of course, you know, we take advantage of dogs and their sense of odor for other things. Interesting study done some years ago was on women and their menstrual cycles, and they thought that to some extent the pheromones that come from males' armpits can help regulate female menstrual cycles. I don't know who participated in that study, but that sounds kind of disgusting. Nonetheless, there is more to learn for us about what the role of apocrine sweat glands are in the human body. So eccrine sweat glands, are they associated with hairs or not? They are not. So apocrines are only associated with hairs. Eccrine sweat glands are not associated with hairs. Case in point, you have eccrine sweat glands on the palms of your hands. There is no hair on the palms of your hands or the soles of your feet. So of course your hands can sweat and so can your feet. That's just a reminder that those eccrine sweat glands open into locations where there's not a hair. The pores on your face are also sweat glands. You know, we often can see those pores if they're open. So there are pores elsewhere. You know, in fact, the eccrine sweat glands are found body-wide. They're just not associated with hairs. So let's talk about the role of sweat. When we talk about sweating, the job is to help cool your body down. So sweat contains mostly water, some salts and proteins, and when you're hot, your body will release sweat from these eccrine sweat glands. It is not the act of sweating that makes you feel cooler. What must happen to that sweat to make you feel cooler? It has to evaporate, right? So with the evaporation of sweat, then you're going to have the sense of coolness because heat is being removed from your body. I also wanted to mention that as the, you know, when we talk about sweat and body odor, it's not the sweat itself that has any kind of odor to it. In fact, sweat that has recently left your pores pretty much has no odor. It's just kind of a salty odor to it. What has to happen for body odor to take place is bacteria that live on your skin eat what's in bacteria, and like any organism, they poop. So it's the poop left behind by your bacteria that gives people a body odor. And sometimes it's what you eat that gives you more of an odor than other people. So, you know, bacteria tend to like certain things in sweat more than others. And, of course, if you're eating things that produce those products, then a person may have more odor than another. So, our tidbit of trivia for today. I do want to mention the next one. It is a bold-faced term there. Ceruminous glands are, in fact, a type of sweat gland. But what are they special? What are they producing?
Earwax.
Earwax, yeah. So, in fact, earwax glands are just modified sweat glands. The last one listed there, mammary glands. Mammary glands, of course, are milk glands. They're only active in females, or at least that's the way they should operate. But mammary glands are producing milk for mothers who are breastfeeding. All right, so let's switch gears. Let's talk about a totally different type of gland. This one is called a sebaceous gland. And what do they produce?
Oil.
Good. The fancy name for oil is?
Sebum.
Good. And oil glands are always, always associated with what? The skin and your hair. Yeah, so these sebaceous glands are always associated with hairs. And like a lot of the other fluids that our bodies produce, these are important for lubricating, waterproofing, and Okay, they're important for lubricating, waterproofing, moisturizing, hair and skin. Lubricate, waterproof, moisturize hair and skin. Lubricate, waterproof, and moisturize hair and skin. First blink, always associated with a hair. Sure. So in this picture, you'll recognize a hair. It's follicle traveling down and around the root. And situated next to that hair is a sebaceous gland. That sebaceous gland, of course, producing oils or sebum. We oftentimes, you know, don't give a lot of credit to what these oil glands are doing. In fact, we do a lot to remove the oils from our skin surface. Frequent bathing, hand washing, washing our hair, all of that helps to remove oils from our body. And we recognize the importance of oil because go into any drugstore, grocery store, box store, and they have aisles filled with lotions, moisturizers, creams, conditioners, and oils, all to put the moisture back into our skin and our hair. So the reason we wash our hands, of course, is for reduction of disease, but in doing so, we wash away the oils on our skin. If you dry out your skin, you leave it open for bacterial infections or fungal infections. So frequent hand washing is good for, you know, saving us from disease, but bad in what it does to the oil. What does frequent hair washing do to the oil in your hair? Dry it out, makes it brittle, right? So we know that brittle hair breaks off, and we replenish the moisture with things like oils and creams, you know, conditioners, because of that necessity to replace that oil back to our hair. So that pocket right there, that's that sebaceous gland that releases sebum onto the skin surface. That little gland can become inflamed, it can become infected with bacteria. And when that's the case, what is the condition called? It's called acne, right? So we know that during teenage years, changes in hormones exacerbate or make worse that inflammation. So we may need medications to help reduce the inflammation or make the skin peel more frequently that affects those sebaceous glands. If you've got skin growing over the top of the pore, this portion up here at the top, then we call this inflamed sebaceous gland a whitehead. If, however, you happen to have an opening there, the pore is exposed, you can actually have melanocytes and melanin and even dirt accumulate in that sebum that comes up to the top, and in that case, we call it a blackhead. So it just depends on whether skin is growing over the top as to whether we have a whitehead or a blackhead. Blackheads also have the addition of melanin, and sometimes some dirt can get in there too. So, of course, either case here can be, you know, problematic for skin's appearance, and we can treat those with medications. All right, so did you get all of your blanks on page 57? Do y'all have any questions so far? All right, on page 59, I left for you a practice page with some skin parts on there. They are labeled for you, so you may want to look at that in preparation for the test next Thursday. Just taking a quick glance over, do you have any questions about any parts on that picture? All right, why don't we move on to page 60? Okay, so now we're going to talk about what skin is important for. What are the skin functions? And on the top of the page there, you'll notice that skin forms the first line of defense against impact from microbes and viruses. So it's a great barrier against the outside world. So we've just talked about several things about the skin that make it a great barrier. One thing that makes skin a great barrier is the fact that we have an epidermis. What is the epidermis made of? Good, there's stratified squamous cells, there's keratin on top, so let's break that down. When we're talking about stratified squamous, what do we mean? Are we talking about one layer thick or many layers? Many layers. So the more layers you've got, the more of a barrier you have to the outside world. So that is an aspect that we want to think of as beneficial. Why is keratin good for the skin? Waterproofing, good. So we've got keratin that creates a dry, waterproof boundary outside. We've got these many layers of cells. What does melanin do for your skin? UV protection, yeah, gives it some color that protects against UV radiation. So right here, just in the epidermis, we've got three things that help us protect our underlying tissues. We've got keratin, we've got multiple layers of the epidermis, and we've got the skin darkening pigment, melanin, which helps protect against UV radiation. We've also got Langerhans cells. What do they help do in the skin? Kill microbes, right? They eat microbes. They're on patrol here. They are moving about. They are cells that we call macrophages. Literally translated, macrophage means what? Yeah. I'm a big eater. That's what a macrophage is. So they patrol, they eat, they digest, and get rid of any kind of microbes and viruses that make their way into the epidermis. The benefit is they prevent those infections from reaching the deeper layer. What is that deeper layer called? Dermis, good. I do want to mention also something about oil, which I didn't mention just a moment ago. The oil that's secreted onto your skin surface tends to be acidic in nature, and that makes it a very inhospitable environment for things like microbes. So the fact that oil in our skin is acidic is another deterrent against microbes living and growing there. What does frequent hand washing do to those microbes?
Wash them off.
So there's a benefit of washing off the microbes, but you also wash away the oil that prevents the microbes from growing in the first place. So we obviously value cleanliness over the beneficial protection of the oil on our skin. So kind of interesting how our culture works. Let's see, we also make vitamin D3 in response to sitting in what? Sunlight, good. Do you know how long per day you would need to sit in the sun to make enough vitamin D?
10 to 15 minutes,
right. So not a long time, probably not long enough to burn. But nonetheless, about 10 to 15 minutes is what we need per day to make enough vitamin D. So if you were to sit in the sun for 6 hours instead of 10 to 15 minutes, what happens to the color of your skin?
You tan up.
So the skin darkens, you have more melanin production, and the more melanin you make, what happens to your vitamin D3 composition or process?
Goes down.
Right, so if 10 or 15 minutes is what it takes to make the vitamin D3 you need to operate on a daily basis, we really don't need any more time than 10 or 15 minutes in the sun. So the point is, long-term sun exposure can actually reduce the amount of vitamin D3 that your skin makes. So melanin actually reduces how much this hormone that your body will make. The good news is that helps to protect your bones. Why your bones? So you have a stable structure. What's the relationship between D3 and bones?
Calcium.
That's it. So that hormone is alternately called calcitriol. D3 is calcitriol. It also regulates calcium and phosphorus metabolism. The main store place for those, or especially for calcium, is in your bones. So if you sit in the sun for a really long time and you produce a lot of vitamin D3, you could actually create brittle bones. So we don't want to go into that avenue of causing bone trouble. We want to make sure that our bones are strong and healthy. So that's another facet of having skin darkening help protect the metabolism that's going on for our bone health. All right, so let's move to sensory reception as our next major function. We have in our epidermis and dermis some sensory receptors that tell us about the world around us. These are called mechanoreceptors, meaning they detect mechanical changes in your environment. That environment, you know, outside your body tells us a lot about what's going on. So the first one there, called a tactile receptor, it responds to fine touch, pressure, and vibration. So if you've been sitting in your car and you feel music coming from the car next to you, you may not hear the music, but you feel the music. Those are what we call tactile receptors. Okay, and so you'll notice how they're shaped. They're shaped kind of like a little heel, and if they're depressed, if you push on them, then they give us a sense of vibration or a sense of fine touch and pressure. So if someone were to lightly lay their hand on your arm, you would feel that in those Meissner corpuscles, alternately called, they're just tactile receptors, just light touch receptors. Tell you something interesting. This is just a side story for a moment. The clothes that you're wearing, they're finely and lightly touching your Meissner corpuscles, or they're tactile receptors. But, you know, after about, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, you're completely unaware of what's touching you. So as long as your clothes don't suddenly become really tight or really loose, you simply stop getting information from the Meissner corpuscles. They stop notifying your brain that you've got a watch on your wrist, earrings in your ears, clothes on your body. All of that stuff eventually is just not told to your brain. Your brain eventually says, yeah, I know it's there. Don't tell me again it's on your body. So your body eventually adapts to whatever's touching or pressing on those tactile receptors. That's good, right? Because then you can focus on other things that are more important besides, I got clothes on. I got clothes on. I got clothes on. Did you know you have clothes on? You got glasses on. You got a watch on. I mean, the brain just finally says enough's enough, right? These deep pressure receptors look like an onion, a little bit of an elongated onion. These deep pressure receptors pick up on a harder push. If you're getting ready to step on a set of train tracks and you fail to notice there's a train coming, your friend may grab your arm, but not lightly. They may grab you with some pressure, deep pressure that pulls you back off that track. If you're feeling the pressure from a tooth being pulled, it's because we are manipulating these onion-shaped deep pressure receptors. So if you've got, you know, a lot of pressure, a lot of push going down on the skin, that feels different, maybe even uncomfortable compared to the fine touch that our tactile receptors pick up on. Okay, so fine touch is a tactile receptor. The lamellated receptors there look like onions. They pick up on deep pressure in the skin. What about these last ones? They look like tree branches. What do they pick up on? Skin distortion. Okay, so let's think about your elbow for just a minute. Your elbow has to bend over your arm, right? Every time you open and close your arm, you can feel that skin move. There's some skin distortion there. You can't really pull your elbow more than that, so there's not going to be a lot of sensation every time you bend your elbow. But let's say that you get a fish hook stuck in your skin. Ouch, right? And the fish hook is pulling, pulling, pulling. And how does that feel to your skin? It hurts. And you know that if it continues to pull, what's going to happen to your skin? Pop it and tear it. Exactly. That's what these receptors are picking up on. These Ruffini corpuscles look like trees. They branch throughout your skin. And if you start to pull your skin to the point of it possibly tearing, we've got problems. So that kind of corpuscle is going to notify you. It's not a pressure sensation. It's not a deep pressure sensation. It's, oh my gosh, my skin feels like it's going to rip. So that rip sensation, that what we expect to happen to our skin, is picked up by those Ruffini corpuscles. So why would it be bad if the fish hook went through your dermis? Well, yeah, you got germs, you got blood down there that can carry those germs. If you tear the dermis, what happens? it won't grow back, right? It's very resistant to growing back because it's made up of, you know, loose areola. It's going to grow a little bit, but what about dense irregular? Does it like to replace itself? Nah. So if we tear that dermis, we've got bigger problems. We've got germs. We've got torn skin that may not grow back. So that's why these Ruffini corpuscles are telling us what's going on. They are in this the skin region where we pick up on pressures, but they're specifically for the potential of tearing that skin. All right. I will not ask you to identify these on a test, by the way, in terms of pictures, but I just wanted to show you how that lamellated one looks kind of like an onion. So if you push on it, it senses that change, and that gives us a feeling of deep pressure. If you've ever had a tooth pulled and you feel it like it feels like it's pushing, well, you're actually activating one of those lamellated corpuscles. All right, let's talk about thermoregulation. That is letter D. Okay, regulation of body temperature is known as thermoregulation, literally body heat regulation. So we're going to talk about how to regulate your body temperature. Normal body temperature is around 98.6. I imagine that if we took everybody's temperature in this room, we would have a little bit higher and a little bit lower. My body temp runs like 97.7. That's just, you know, normal for me. So 98.6 is an average there. That's what it is for most people, but not everybody. In Celsius, you'll notice the average is around 37 degrees Celsius. Okay. So the skin actually plays a large role in helping us to maintain body temperature. Let's talk about what happens when we're too cold first. So if you're too cold, do you need to sweat? No, because sweat takes what away from you? Takes heat away. Yeah, so we don't want to have sweat evaporating and losing that heat from our bodies when we're cold. If you are sweating and you're cold, then you're probably sick, right? So we know that cold sweats indicate something else going on in the body. That's not a normal way for us to operate. So first thing there, sweat glands remain inactive. What happens to the skeletal muscles when you're cold? They shiver. Is that an involuntary or a voluntary action? It's involuntary, right? So if you're involuntarily shivering, it might mean that you're cold. What does shivering do to your body temperature? Heat you up, right? So it raises that body temp. Let's talk about the next word there, vasoconstriction. What is the prefix vaso? Yeah, like vessels, like it sounds kind of like a vein. It just means blood vessels in general are going to constrict. So if you've got normal blood flow, when you vasoconstrict that vessel, you actually squeeze that blood vessel, you make the vessel smaller, and you make it harder for blood to flow through that vessel. If you vasoconstrict the vessels that are found in your dermis, you're making it harder for blood to flow through your dermis. And you say, well, you know, gosh, you know, if I'm cold, how is that going to help me?
You don't waste the heat.
Waste the heat, right. So if you are cold and your vessels constrict, that squeezes and reduces the blood flow to your upper portions of the skin. That keeps the heat closer into your body and doesn't waste the heat. So where do we really want the heat and the blood to go if you're really, really cold?
Organs
and
your brain.
Organs and your brain. So that midline area, right? Are you going to die if your pinky finger falls off? Nah. You could live without your whole arm, right? But if you have damage done to your heart, your lungs, if they're frostbitten, that's probably not compatible with good life. So when we're cold, we reduce blood flow to our extremities. That's why your hands and your feet get cold. And we instead channel that blood to our vital organs. We want them to stay functional. If you reduce blood flow to fingers and toes, what color do they turn? They turn blue, and the fancy name for that is cyanosis. Good. All right. So what does vasoconstriction mean? Squeeze the blood vessel. And does that increase blood flow or decrease blood flow to an area? it decreases it, right? So we want to make sure that our skin is not nourished with blood as much as our vital organs. We want to make sure the vital organs get the blood. We reduce blood flow to our skin, especially on those extremities. Okay, so let me get those blanks there for you. Vasoconstriction reduces flow of blood. That helps us to prevent heat loss. And so why do you think cold skin appears blue? No blood. Yeah, lack of blood flow. Okay, so vasoconstriction reduces flow of blood to prevent heat loss. Cold skin appears blue due to a lack of blood. And this is how it happens. You can see this vessel here has constricted. That shuts off or reduces the blood flow to the upper portion of the dermis. And then, of course, when we have reduced blood flow to the dermis, that channels that blood down deeper into our bodies and, of course, forces it toward our vital organs. If our skin appears blue, it just simply means that we have a lack of oxygen and a lack of blood flowing to that area. One more thing happens when you're cold. These erector pili muscles are attached to our hairs. They will stand those hairs on end. And what is the point of doing that when we're cold? That's true, but that's something. Right, it puffs air around your skin. So if all your hairs are laying down when you're normal temperature, if all of a sudden your hairs stand on end on your skin surface,
you got a fur coat.
You got a fur coat, exactly. So trapped between all those hairs that are now standing up, you've got air. And that air is warmed by your body, and so that is meant to help keep you warm. So, you know, if you got goosebumps and you're cold, there's a point behind that. It's to help trap the air closer to you, keep you warmer. Okay, so erector pili muscles stand hairs on end. They're blanked there for why? It traps air closer to the body. Okay, so that traps air closer to the body. That helps keep us warm. Just like a fur coat. That's a good one.
Or fuzzy.
Yeah. If we just had more hair, right, we might be more effective at keeping our bodies warm. So, have any of you lived up north? Just you? Just you. Okay, so where did you live?
North.
So, did you live there for very long? Okay, so when you were up, were you coming from south to north? Mm-hmm. So, how did your first winter up there feel? So, were you colder than your friends and everybody you knew?
I feel like they was used to it, the cold, so I was used to living in the cold.
Okay, that's what I'm hitting on. So, if you are used to living in our hot and humid south and you went up there, you probably were just freezing. And
yeah,
they were like, cool. They thought no big deal, right? It's just wintertime. Okay, so there is a physiological difference between people who live in hot climates and people who live in cold climates. If you are used to living in the hot south with the heat and the humidity that we have, you actually have vessels closer to the top portions of the dermis of your skin. And so the reason for having these vessels so common in your skin is to help you stay what? Help you stay cool. What does having those vessels in the upper dermis do for you? Well, let the heat out, right?
Yeah,
so if you've got a lot of vessels in the top portion of your skin, you're going to let the heat out all the time. So your skin may appear hot, it may appear red, but that's good because if you live in a hot environment, you want the heat to escape your body. If you now go up north and live, you got problems, right? Because you're used to radiating heat out of your vessels, and the people that live up north in a cold environment are not used to radiating heat. their vessels actually reside in the deeper portions of the dermis, and that helps them maintain their heat and not lose so much to the environment. So if you go up there and spend a winter, you know, it may feel like the coldest place on earth, and other people that have always lived there think, what's the big deal? So it takes at least a year living in a new climate for our bodies to change the way the vessels are grown in the dermis so that you don't either burn up in the summer's heat in the south or freeze to death in the cold north. So interesting there that there is physiologically a difference in the way that our vessels grow between southerners and northerners. Let's talk about what happens when you're too hot. What happens to those Ekron sweat glands? They open up, you sweat, right? And what does sweat do that helps you feel better? Cool you off, right? So, of course, the evaporation of that sweat is what makes you feel cooler. So when we evaporate and lose the heat, we lose the fluids as well. All right, so Ekron sweat glands activate. That cools us down. Let's talk about vasodilation. Let's go back to our previous picture. When you've got vasodilation happening, you'll notice that the diameter of the vessel increases in size, and that increase in size means that we've now got more blood flowing through those vessels. If this is in the upper portions of your dermis, we now have blood flowing closer to the skin surface, and blood carries heat. That heat is going to escape from our body's surfaces and out to the environment. So that's a good thing for us to have those vessels closer to the top of the dermis. It helps us to radiate heat out to the environment. So what does vasodilation mean is happening to that vessel?
Expanding.
Expanding, right. And how does that help us out when we're too hot? Yeah, raise that heat to the surface, let it escape to the atmosphere. Okay, so in this case, you've got a lot of blood circulating toward your extremities. And in that case, how might your skin appear if you are pushing blood close to the skin surface? Flush. It may feel hot to the touch. It may look pinkish or red or flushed. And that is all about losing as much heat as you can to the atmosphere. Okay, so let me catch those blanks there for you. Vasodilation increases flow of blood. Okay, vasodilation increases flow of blood, and hot skin appears red. Why is that?
More blood flow.
More blood flow. Good. So more blood flow means your skin may appear red or even hot to the touch. So more blood flow. So thermoregulation is a big deal in terms of our skin's functions. It helps us to maintain, proper body temperature through changing the way our blood flows through that skin. I did want to mention the question at the very bottom of your page, what is heat stroke? What happens to us that promotes heat stroke? Yeah, you overheat, you can't cool, and you stop sweating. And the problem with stopping sweating is meant to cool you down. And if you can no longer sweat, you're only relying on vasodilation. And if it's 110 degrees outside and you're working and you're building up heat in your body and you're not sweating, you cannot radiate off enough heat just simply through vasodilation. So what happens to your body temperature when you stop sweating?
It goes up.
It goes up, right. So the issue here is if you stop sweating and you're outside, you've got serious problems because you need to rehydrate, you need to drink in order to allow your body to continue sweating. So when you stop sweating, that's going to promote increase in body temperature. If you increase the body temperature, sometimes people get delusional. They don't behave like they're themselves. They may act out of it. What else may happen during a heat stroke? Could have a seizure. Okay, people may faint. And probably worst case scenario is if your body temperature raises to 108 degrees and stays there, you can die from a heat stroke. So heat stroke is no joke. It's nothing to play with. Anybody who has stopped sweating runs the risk of a heat stroke. So staying properly hydrated, meaning drinking a little bit all along, will help maintain hydration rather than just drinking a huge amount of water at one time. Our kidneys can only process so much fluid in a short period of time.
So when you stop sweating, is it increasing?
In body temperature. And that increase in body temperature is what can promote heat stroke. Alright, so as promised, we have a revisit to wound healing, and this process was discussed back in chapter 4 at the very end. Let's revisit wound healing, but this time with a kind of focus on how skin heals itself. Let's say that you've had a paper cut. I know paper cuts sound like they're no big deal, but paper cuts, you know, pretty nasty, right? The first thing that you have happen when you get a paper cut is maybe a little bit of bleeding. That is involved in the very first phase there. It's called the inflammatory phase. Back in the chapter 4 material, we talked about the four cardinal signs of inflammation. Do you recall those four cardinal signs?
Hot, swollen, red.
And painful. Yeah, red, hot, swollen, and painful. So, you know, paper cuts don't feel very good, as would no cut. So of course, you know, inflammation involves bleeding, that involves redness, swelling. We have pain associated with this inflammation. But there's actually some good that's happening during inflammation. You know, it gets a bad rap because it doesn't feel very good for us. During inflammation, we've got, you know, some bleeding taking place there. That can actually wash away some of the microbes. And of course, we don't want microbes to hang around in an open wound. That is very quickly followed by the second phase, which is called the migratory phase. Once a scab is formed during the first phase, that inflammatory phase, we now have kind of a stabilized blood clot in place that we can now start rebuilding in. We have white blood cells that migrate into this blood clot. Why are they important?
They fight bacteria.
Good. So they're going to help clean up the place. They also help to eat and destroy dead tissue. So they're going to remodel that wound and hopefully open it up for some new cells to move in. You'll notice that fibroblasts will also move in. What do fibroblasts do? Rebuild new tissues, right? So they're going to build new fibers, maybe collagen in this area. And that's all going to be part of this migratory phase where these helping and healing cells move into that wound. That is followed by the proliferation phase. We just continue rebuilding the tissue here. Most of the time when we damage skin, we have fibroblasts rebuild new collagen fibers down in the dermis. What do you know about collagen fibers? What do they provide for tissues? Support. Good. Are they very stretchy? They're not. So they're great for providing support to this newly built tissue. They're just not very stretchy. And if you end up leaving the wound filled with nothing but collagen fibers, you have what is called scar tissue left behind. So how does scar tissue feel? Thick. Does it stretch? No, because it's mostly what fibers? Mostly collagen. So if you have great damage to some tissue, maybe all that's left behind is scar tissue. That's just collagen fibers. You don't have the stretchiness, you don't have the flexibility, nor do you have the regular components such as glands, hair, or even nails. So we hope that when we are healing damaged skin, we don't simply stop with scar tissue during the maturation phase. We hope that we take it one step further and replace that scar tissue with normal, natural tissue. So, you know, when we talk about keloids and scar tissues and things of that sort, we're talking about skin that probably didn't heal correctly. For whatever reason, that collagen fiber was left in place and we didn't regrow with normal tissues. All right, so inflammation, migration, proliferation of those healing cells, finally maturation phase means that we've finished the healing process and hopefully we're going to replace that scar tissue with something that's functional. Do y'all have questions so far about anything we've covered? All right, so let's talk about skin burns. So we know that skin provides a protective environment around the outsides of our bodies. And if you happen to have damage to that skin through a burn, we immediately are concerned about fluid loss. Another concern is the loss of our protective covering. You know, no more stratified squamous, keratin, oils, all of that stuff would be gone during a burn. And now, without that skin covering, we can have microbes grow into that area. So give it 24 hours and a burn is going to be now invaded by bacteria, maybe even viruses that can go into deeper parts of our bodies. Another side effect of a burn is protein denaturation. We talked about denaturing proteins back in chapter 2. What does that mean has happened to your protein structure? The active site's messed up, right? So the whole structure is destroyed and the protein is basically functionless. No more jobs for those proteins to do. So if you happen to have skin burns, then the proteins like your collagen may denature. And unfortunately, that can affect the rest of our bodies, like our kidneys. Let's talk about burn severity. And there's 4 degrees to burn severity. There's a first degree, second degree, third degree, and fourth degree. There is no such thing as a 0 degree or fifth degree burn, just 1 through 4. And the numbers here are based on how deep into the skin we burn. I like this picture because it really shows you that if you burn into the epidermis, that's the first layer of skin, that's a first degree. If you burn into the dermis, that's the second layer of skin, that's of course a second degree. The hypodermis is technically not part of the skin, but if you're counting regions here, that's the third layer down, that's a third degree. And under most hypodermis is muscle, so if you burn as far deep into the body as muscle, that is now a fourth degree burn. So first degree burns, you may know, are pretty painful as it is. They are fleeting pain. They shouldn't last more than a couple of days. And this can cause inflammation of the skin's epidermis. Why the epidermis? It's the top layer of your skin. Do we expect dermis damage in a first degree burn? No, because like we just talked, it's just affecting that uppermost layer of the skin, just that epidermis. So we notice that the skin may appear red in color, it may appear hot to the touch. This all sounds like the cardinal signs of what? Sunburn, yeah. So it's inflammation, pain, hot, redness, swelling. Sunburn is one reason we may experience these pains. What else can do this to a person? Hot water, yeah. Electricity can do it. So there's other things besides, radiation can do it, other things can do it besides just, you know, the sun's exposure. I put a cup in the microwave years ago. I wanted some hot tea and I didn't have the patience to wait for the kettle to boil with the hot tea. Put the cup in the microwave, just a glass mug, and put it on there for like 2 or 3 minutes. And when I went to take the mug out of the microwave, the water exploded out of the cup. The cup itself was fine, the cup didn't explode. But they say if you microwave water that way, you should stick like a tea bag or a wooden stick in because it can superheat in the microwave. First degree burns all over my arm from where it exploded coming out of the microwave. You know, so beware of microwaving things like water. That can give you a first degree burn. Yeah.
I had a second degree burn on my whole back when I was little.
Ooh.
Yeah, I was playing in the kitchen.
What, did you get water spilled on you?
Water, yeah, oh. The boiling. Me and my brother was fighting it. We was cooking hot dogs and the boiling water fell on my back.
Oh, how awful.
And I got, it was second degree burn. And I remember like I was jumping up and when I took my shirt off, I had a whole layer of skin on my shirt.
Oh, how painful. So you were old enough to remember that, I take it?
Mm, yeah, I was 16.
Oh, gosh.
I knew that.
Ouch.
I feel old.
That makes me hurt, yeah, yeah.
I had big blisters.
Did they give you any ointment for it, or?
Well, we went straight to the hospital, and they had popped them, or whatever, drained them. And I remember before we went to the hospital, Me and my brother was putting butter on them because, but the doctor said that was a bad idea because it was hard for them to get to it since it's so slippery.
Yeah. So then they had to, I guess, wash that off?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ouch.
And I had to go to the birth center, like, what's it?
Wow, you must have done a number on your back. Ouch. So any problems with it healing? That's good. That's good.
I can't really tell, though.
And you make a point because first degree and second degree usually heal without any kind of problems. So. Yeah, second degree can get you into the dermis of the skin. And of course, you hit the nail on the head. There's blisters with second degree. That's a telltale sign that a person does have second degree burns. And, you know, you were right to have them drain them at the hospital because if we were to do that at home, you know, you always hear don't pop the blister, right? Because that can introduce what?
Infection.
Right. So, of course, with a second degree burn, we've got more to be concerned about. That water blister that pops up is actually a form between the epidermis and the dermis. Any kind of microbes or bacteria that get into that dermis now have the opportunity to travel anywhere in your body. So we want to be careful with those blisters. Third degree burns actually destroy epidermis, dermis, and where do they burn to? Hypodermis, yeah. So in this picture, you'll notice it looks like an area in here that looks a different color than the stuff around. This in here is likely a third degree burn. It's burned to the hypodermis. And in the place where it's a third degree, we've actually burned off the nerve endings in the skin. So that is unfortunate because we've now got major skin damage, no feeling in that skin, and the surrounding burns look red and inflamed. Those are probably second degree burns. So that's very painful around the third degree burn. Yeah. This is a really bad looking third degree burn. You can see the fat tissue down there, that yellow. So in this case, we're looking at skin grafts. Yeah, so unfortunately, if you burn, you know, epidermis and dermis, you've got nothing really to regrow back. So skin grafting may occur. They'll take samples from elsewhere and replace it there. Fourth degree burn burns epidermis, dermis, hypodermis, and into the muscle tissue. And this could be, if I remember correctly, a hot water burn. Yeah, so that is just dead tissue. That's, you know, very hard to deal with because you've got dead skin and muscle underneath also. I wanted to show you a really cool thing called the Skin Gun. It's on Nat Geo's website. It's on YouTube also. And I don't know why this is not more commonly in use. But this video is actually 5 years old, so it's not a new technology.
Skin is the largest organ in the body, and when it's severely burned, it needs to be replaced quickly and massively.
The stainer techniques that we have now, that takes weeks, months sometimes. And the reason why people die is because of the infections that develop while we're waiting for the skin to heal.
How are you doing, pain wise?
Good.
Okay.
So if we can find a way to get normal, healthy skin, as much of it as we want, within a week, that's the holy grail of burn surgery.
George Gerlach thinks he's found a way, but he'll need a gun.
We call it the skin cell gun. A device for the deposition of skin cells onto the wound.
It looked like something you'd see in Star Wars.
This is Matt Uro, state police officer from Pennsylvania. He's one of the first people to be treated with the gun.
I attended a July 5th party at a friend's house, and there was a small bonfire. I was standing next to the bonfire, and an individual decided to throw a cup of gasoline on the fire. The worst part was my face. It was the whole right side of my face here. my ear, my neck, and my shoulder, and the entire top part of my arm.
Uramid suffered severe second-degree burns. This photo shows what a second-degree burn looks like.
The arm kind of looked like a piece of charred meat, like a hot dog that was left on a grill too long. The doctor said that I might be a candidate for this new procedure, which is a spray gun, and asked me if I would be interested.
Skin cell spraying is like paint spraying. Just, you need a more sophisticated device, like computer controlled. We isolate cells from the healthy part of the skin, the patient's own cells, which can be taken in a water solution, and that solution is prepared for cell spraying.
Basically what they're doing was taking my stem cells from my skin and putting them all in the gun and spraying it on my arm.
Scientists have been able to regenerate sheets of skin for decades. The problem is it takes weeks for that skin to grow, and the new skin is extremely fragile. Gerlach's gun solves both of these problems.
It takes like 1.5 hours to take the biopsy, to isolate the cells, and to spray the cells.
This is what Urim's skin probably looked like before treatment. This is what it looked like 4 days after it was sprayed with his own stem cells.
They did it on a Friday, and my follow-up was that Monday, and Bernie had said it was healed, completely healed.
Though the skin gun is still experimental, over a dozen patients have already been successfully treated.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Thanks.
All right, so let me switch it off. So you wonder why something like that isn't like every burn unit's go-to, but apparently it's still being worked out. I mean, what do you say, 4 days? Yeah, that's impressive. All right, so just a little bit left for us. Rule of nines down at the very bottom. Let me hit that with you. So when we talk about people's burns and we talk about, you know, they've been burned over a certain percentage of the body, they actually use this rule of nines to provide an estimate for burns. The front of the body and the anterior trunk, you'll notice, is about 18% of the body's surface area. The back is also 18%. Each leg front is 9%. Each back leg is 9%. So, you know, if they say somebody's been burned over a certain percentage of the body, they're using this to kind of give an estimate. Body parts that aren't very big, like arms, you know, don't really contribute a whole lot to how much burn percentage is calculated. So I just wanted to share this with you so you would know when they calculate a burn, it's based on this rule of nines. Basically, the body being divided up into 9% or some function of 9% portions. All right, so last thing for us there is skin cancers. And that's from page 62. So skin cancers can arise due to changes in our body's DNA. And considering that the skin comes into contact with all sorts of things in the outside world, there's an opportunity there for those skin cells to become mutated, meaning that their DNA may change and they may no longer go through the normal cell cycle. When cells no longer go through the cell cycle like they're supposed to, they may skip interphase. They may go from, you know, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase, and they say, that was fun, let's do it again. They go right back into prophase and skip interphase. Yeah, so that can create tumors and problems in other tissues, but especially in epithelials like your skin. First off, let's define what it means to have a benign tumor versus a malignant tumor. Which one is situated only in that particular tissue? Benign, good. And malignant tumors, what does that mean has happened?
Metastasis,
it has spread to other tissues, right. T- types of cancers here, carcinomas affect the skin. These are typically epithelial cancers, which, by the way, are the most common cancers. Epithelial tissues grow fast. They come in contact with things that can create changes in their cells. So, of course, they're the ones that are going to have the most opportunity to undergo cancer. What do adenocarcinomas impact? Glands, right. I had a student years ago, she had salivary gland cancer, and it was slow growing, which was good for her that it was slow growing, but nonetheless, you know, they kept having to cut out cancers from around her jawline. So, yeah, you can have cancer in the salivary glands, other glands as well, because of those epithelial cells. Sarcomas, they affect bone. They also affect muscles, but you have probably never heard of heart cancer, right? Okay? You probably have never heard of skeletal muscle tissue cancers. So those two are on our list from, gosh, about a week or so ago. Do those kinds of tissues grow quickly? No. So if you're a slow-growing tissue, you're probably going to not have too much risk for cancer with a slow-growing tissue. Lymphomas, you'll notice, is next. They affect what? Lymph nodes. Yep, so lymphomas affect the lymph tissues, like lymph nodes, and leukemias affect the blood. So in terms of cancer rates here, you'll notice that lung cancer, prostate cancer, colon and rectal cancer, even pancreatic cancer, these can all be epithelial tissue cancers. Same thing for females, breast cancer, colon cancer, ovary cancer, uterine cancer, gosh, these top numbers here are often epithelial tissue cancers. And it has to do with the fact that they grow fast. Even these brain cancers and nervous system cancers are not nervous tissue that's growing. It's quite likely the other cells, the support cells in the neuroglia, that are growing and creating those cancers. So those cells in our bodies that grow quickly are oftentimes at more risk for producing tumors or cancers. There's three kinds of skin cancers I'd like to cover for you. They're at the very bottom of your page. They're oftentimes due to UV radiation. Sometimes they're genetic. Sometimes, you know, they run in families. And the first one there is called a basal cell carcinoma. You'll notice in this picture, these basal cell carcinomas are even pretty sizable. And you'll notice that they tend to affect the stratum basal. Where's stratum basal located?
At the
bottom of the epidermis. Good. And what activity is happening there?
Mitosis,
right? A lot of cell reproduction. So if those cells are actively reproducing, then there's a chance for them to become cancerous. People who have basal cell carcinomas oftentimes find a sore on their bodies, oftentimes the face, and it may be a sore that just continues to scab and then bleed and then scab and then bleed. And if they get that checked, you can see here, you know, if they get that checked, then they have a chance of getting it cut out and removed. A surgery called Mohs surgery, it's spelled M-O-H. You don't need to know that. I just thought I'd share it with you. Mohs surgery is used. So if you've ever had a bad spot on an apple, you've performed Mohs surgery on the apple. What you typically do is, if this is the basal cell carcinoma, you've probably taken your knife and cut the bad spot out of the apple. And if there's still some bad spot on your apple, you probably cut again, and you cut again, and you cut again, until what? Your bad spot's gone, your good stuff is left, right? So Mohs surgery just takes until they get clean borders. This should have clean boundaries or borders and no cancer cells. And that may be so large that they need to patch up with, you know, a skin patch. They'll do that. They'll peel that skin back up and, of course, watch to make sure that it doesn't reinfect or, you know, re-come back with that cancer. So basal cell carcinomas are easy to spot because they typically show up as a scab that just bleeds, it re-scabs, it re-bleeds. However, left untreated, they can become really large and very hard to treat, like these here. They tend not to metastasize. That's on the scalp.
My tennis instructor had his head done multiple times.
Oh, goodness.
He kept getting them. He was almost bald by the time he was 40.
Wow.
They started removing them in his 50s, and all into his 70s, he's still.
little stitches or
anything. Yeah, he's probably stopping that.
It's just awful to have that man constantly covering.
He played tennis for years and years and wouldn't wear a hat.
So that's what happens, right? That's an exposure. Somebody that works here has these, and his mom had them, so could be some exposure.
This guy's real fair. He's blonde. He's younger and he's bald.
And of course, that just makes it even worse for that skin cancer, yeah. So these don't metastasize.
That's like if you leave it and let it grow and grow. That's
yeah.
Pictures, right?
Yeah.
That's scary.
So you don't want to let them get to that point, obviously, because cutting that out through nose surgery is going to be a big deal. But these are not likely to metastasize like other skin cancers would. Squamous cell, oh, that's one there at the face. Just a recurrent one. Squamous cell carcinoma affects keratinocytes, those keratin-producing cells. And instead of being a scab that just doesn't heal, they oftentimes look more like a little scaly, crusty growth on the skin. Like these here, this one actually looks like it's got some coloration to it. You know, left untreated, they can also become larger. We don't want to leave them until they're that point, you know, that big. But the real serious skin cancer to watch out for is melanoma. Melanoma can metastasize and spread to other tissues. And for that reason, we have this ABCDE rule to help us identify those potential targets for melanomas. You know, if you look at your body, you may have some dark colored freckles or moles, and you want to watch those because over a lifetime, they may change. And that actually is this E, enlarging or changing. So what we're looking for is asymmetrical, meaning the two sides don't look the same. We're looking for border irregularity. Let's get you one of those. See, this one up here doesn't have a regular border to it. It just looks like it's random. We notice different colors. There's another great one with border irregularity. They may be blue, black, brown, all sorts of colors mixed in together there. So multicolored moles are a problem. D for diameter. They should not be bigger than a pencil eraser. And E for enlarging. They may be changing or growing, and that's another warning sign of a melanoma. So you'll notice that if you look at enough of these are metastasized melanomas, that these dark spots that tend to grow are the ones you want to watch. They say that you should strip naked and look at yourself in front of a mirror at least once a year or have someone look at you for these changing spots. So you should be aware of what's on your body that tends to look like these oddballs. They say it's not looking for one to fit perfectly in the role, but to look for an ugly duckling. And this one here would certainly fit the bill for being an ugly duckling. They can affect your gums, too. I don't know if you noticed, but that was a penis in an earlier picture. It can affect all skin portions, bottom left there. So, yeah, all portions of your body are at risk for, you know, melanomas. All right. Y'all have a good one. I'll see you on Thursday.